in your introduction, I just want to make sure I get this right. You're 21 now?
Yeah, I just turned 21 like a month. Yeah, in February. I just turned 21.
Okay. February 18th.
Yeah, there we go.
Happy birthday.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Okay, well, let's get started then.
Listening to 515, the Ultraman podcast, the show that invites you into the lives of people who make up the Ultra family. Here's your host for these conversations, co-race director of Ultraman Canada, Larry Ryan.
Thank you, MJ. Today I speak with Jordan Bryden, the 2019 UMC and world champion. Steve King's Stories features an Aussie known as the Honey Badger. And in the UMC athlete profile, Andrew Peterson shares how he approaches the sport as a younger, less experienced athlete. My guest today started triathlon at 9 years of age and has been racing competitively since 15. He's won numerous national titles, a junior world Xterra title, and has landed on the podium at various distances around the world. Pre-pandemic, he was hitting his stride in July of 2019. He pulled off two major races, finishing third at the Canada Man X-Tri event and winning Ultraman Canada with an amazing day one start, recording a record swim time of 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 40 seconds. In October in 2019, he moved on to Spain, racing Ironman Barcelona in 8 hours and 35 minutes and challenged Mallorca. He capped the year off with another championship, this time in Kona in November, at the Ultraman Worlds, where he proudly represented Canada. My guest today from Canmore, Alberta, Mr. Jordan Bryden.
Hey, Larry. Good to see you. It's been a while.
Yeah. Yes, it has. When lots of people are not seeing each other these days, except for through these types of mediums.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely miss the community and the crowd. And I got a small chance to catch up with a few people in Penticton last summer, but that was about it, you know. Little social distance gatherings, but that's about all you get these days.
Yeah. So I'm not exactly where I should start with you, but if we want to go right back to the beginning, I guess maybe that's the best place to start. People usually start off with swimming or running and finding success there and then moving into triathlon. Surely at age 9, you weren't already a success at one of those things, were you?
No, not at all. I love to run. My dad was a runner. My parents were pretty active. Parents were, pretty busy. Me and my sister kept them busy. We lived in a small town in Airdrie. But my dad would always go out for runs at night. And I always thought that was so cool, right? It was you go do your run after dark and just see what the little city is like after dark. So that was it's kind of interesting and intriguing to me. And from that point, it was just I want to run. And my dad decided that at that age, we were going to buy a treadmill. And we went into a bike store that also sold treadmills, Cycle Path, back in the days here in Calgary. And the owner right there kind of got me interested in the Kids of Steel program because they were a co-sponsor of it. And That was my first kind of exposure to any sort of competition in any sort of manner as a kid. So it was a lot of fun to kind of show up for that first race and not have a clue what I was doing and just have this a totally new experience without any any exposure to that. So.
And had you had any swimming at that point?
No. It was I'd never seen my parents compete in anything. I've never done anything outside of school. So it was really a very raw, emotional, super fun thing where you just felt like a rock star on that course at that age, right? Rolling around on your mountain bike thinking you're going so fast. You can't believe they shut the whole road down just for you. And I was a horrible swimmer. I'd only learned really to swim four lengths straight about two or three days before. Me and my dad were working on it for a couple months, but you know, at that age, I it wasn't clicking. And then, yeah, so I got into that first Kids of Steel and was confident I could do four lengths of freestyle. I couldn't. I ended up doing two lengths of backstroke. I was the second last one out of the water. But then I also had, I think I had the fastest run on the day. So,
okay.
Yeah, that was the spark. It was,
you find
it was
your going strength. Through
the, yeah, I was going through those results and being like, I'm not that good here. I'm not, oh, but I'm good here. So.
And then, you know, fast forward to 2019 and you set a swim record at 10K in the Ultraman Canada.
Yeah, no, the swim was something that I always felt more at home in the water than I did on land. I think, grew up in a swim club that was very, very motivating, very fun. Just like when you have that ability to just have your real community and your friendship group, not necessarily at school, but like at the pool, it was a lot of fun. I then just really embraced all the challenges that come along with that, because nobody as a swim club swimmer has it right. You know, you're competitive with your buddies. You go out and do a race, but you might be good at the 100 freestyle, but they're better at the 100 back. So you're always right. Changing, and there's never a lack of competition. So I fully embraced my swim club days and felt more at home, like I said, on the pool deck than anywhere else. So,
And now you're considered a pro triathlete.
Yeah.
You race in the pro division. Does someone have to say that you are a pro, or is it more like a pro poker player where, you know, well, if I'm going to spend all this money on all these tournaments, I'm going to call myself a pro because this is all I live for. And well, like, what's the ticket for you to get to being a pro status? What's the format?
Yeah, so it's different in every country. Absolutely. In Canada, pretty much you come through the ranks. Either you have to, if you were to say going into any sort of long course racing, from no previous history of racing, you would have to prove yourself with, I think it is 3 age group podiums at races that are deemed to be large enough fields in order to get your pro card that way. Mm-hmm. I raced as a junior elite when you start going through clinics on how to race the ITU style, and just kept growing with that. Eventually, you know, raced junior U23 and then elite, trying to pursue the Olympics. And so that was kind of where I got my start, you know, down that road, and then started to get more and more interested in the longer distance stuff, the more I wasn't able to compete with the Simon Whitfields of the world.
Yeah. Are you a stats guy? Do you keep track of your own stats? Would Steve King know your stats better than you do?
I know enough of my stuff. Yeah. I can recite what I did in swim practice at 14 years old on 100 fly.
Okay, so if I needed you are a to, stats so. Guy. Because okay. When I was looking at your stats, I saw in 2015, you're tuned into a pretty consistent pace on your 70.3, where you were coming in at 4 hours. One was your best finish at that distance, but yep. One was just over 4 and one was just under 4. Do you know the times?
I did go 357 at one point.
Okay.
Yeah, past that point, I know I went 402 one year in Calgary, where I actually had a mechanical and was really hoping to get on the podium in that race. I'd actually raced Challenge Roth the weekend before and just come off of a big training camp with Daniela Reif. So that was probably the best I ever felt going into it. But some of my races in Asia, in Korea, were my best podium finishes when it came to 70.3s and getting
pretty close. That's one of the ones that I saw there. Yeah.
Yeah. Never quite took the top spot on the podium, but wound up in second or third. So.
And so like when you're right around that 4 hour mark, do you get a little annoyed when you go over the 4 versus just under the 4? Does that make a difference to you as a racer to see that 4 or the 3:59? Like,
No, actually, like when it comes to the fallout after the race, the time doesn't really matter to me. I kind of got over that as a swimmer. I went, my best 1500 ever was 1701. And like, that's, you know, that's the, when you're a swimmer, being a sub 17 guy is like where you start to be a real swimmer. Mm. And so that, that's kind of where I was able to kind of emotionally let go of breaking the actual time barriers and just focus a little bit more on the race itself and trying to instead be as strategic as possible during the event rather than worry about the overall outcome from a time perspective.
Yeah. So you're a strategic racer in that you're racing your opponent. You're not racing a certain time that you're trying to get.
Yeah. I always prefer to just think of it as I'm a racer, not a pacer. Right. Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot of Ironman guys that are very successful at being pacers. But I think when you see the biggest performers, the people who are able to really, dig in the screws when it matters most, those guys are out there not worrying about what they did in practice for their watts per kilogram or, you know, right. they're out there looking at the next guy and strategically making the smallest move that every 5 seconds that hurts me, I got to make 10 seconds that hurts them. So yeah, it's a little bit more fun.
One of the things that I like to do with the podcast is make sure that when we get great, you know, athletes like yourself in, that we get some practicals, some takeaways of suggestions of how to train better or what you do that's made you successful. And I'm guessing for you, maybe along the way, maybe it was your dad, your first coach, or there was a coach along the way that tweaked something for you. Is there something that at one point where it was just like, okay, once I got that, it made a big difference in my performance, whether it was the swim, bike, or run. Is there a coach that you could shout out to and say like, hey, I really appreciate when you gave me that?
Yeah, actually. So I worked with, a few different national team coaches growing up. You know, I've had very, very cool people around me my entire career. Tom Ponting was very influential with me. He was my swim coach for the better part of, I think, 7 years. He won 3 Olympic medals in swimming. And past that, you know, I had Kel Zariski in Calgary, who's probably one of the best age groupers ever at anything in the sport of triathlon. He's 8-time Xterra world champion. So relying off of his experience and his understanding of sports science is something that I've always gone back to. However, the biggest difference was definitely Sutton, like working with Brett Sutton. He's a different animal all in all. He really teaches his athletes to just think for themselves in a whole different way. Like, you know, you don't show up to practice with a GPS. You don't have a power meter on your bike. They aren't even an option. Like, you know, if you want it thrown off the pool deck, yeah, you bring it to practice, but that's about maybe as close as you're going to get to actually using it. And he just really, changed the way that I kind of thought about how I could be successful as an athlete. I'm a bigger guy, you know, I'm 6'5". When I raced Ultraman Worlds last year, I was over 200 pounds. I think I'm the first Clydesdale to ever win Ultraman Worlds in that case. But,
congratulations.
I didn't cut any weight last year at all because I was coming off of a bad injury. But that self-belief that you don't have to have this, and this. You don't have to do the things that, you know, all the sports scientists say. You just have to let go and focus on the hard work. That was the real big shift. I was able to spend a lot of time around, you know, Nicola Spearing. I was her training partner getting ready for the Olympics. And I've never met a more professional athlete who had a higher degree of faith in their coach than Nicola and Brett. There was nothing but pure like self-respect for both of them and understanding if Brett needed something done, there was, you know, there's no questioning it, there's no there was no going a different direction other than what the coach said to do. And then the support of just having a really high performance squad around you that was always willing to support you and push you to that next level. That was the breaking point for me where I decided in my own mind, hey, like, you know, I can actually be good at this. And it was just that self-belief that a coach can sometimes just get through to you, right? It's like, no, you're good. Like, you can do this. And it's not an individual, like, pinprick that you can put on something and say, this is what made it. But I do know that when I did leave Sutton's squad, he was cutting a lot of people. He was really making a smaller team that was a little bit easier for him to manage just in Switzerland, that I then saw the other side of that too. I then had a few months where I just simply thought, like, I have had this, I've had what, you know, a lot of people regard as the best coach in the world and the best training squad in the world. And now I don't. And so that was a totally different learning and understanding for myself, because when you've kind of had the opportunity to experience that, it takes a lot to really dig deep and be able to understand that you can do that as well outside of that system. is they see the glitz, they see the highest end bike, they see, you know, the right training program or the right coaching program, or at this point, a lot of people are really focused on if they can be in the pool or not, or if they're riding enough miles.
It just
doesn't matter. Like, you just have to, you have to focus, your self-belief in that respect first. If you can do that, then you can kind of continue down that pathway.
And do you think that your ability to mentally handle that and to, you know, be mentally tough when it comes to racing, is that one of the things that's led to your success then?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Ultraman crowd is a very different amount of crazy. You know, you definitely like talk to each other about their stories and the things that motivated them. And you see Arnaud, and like, he'll just throw himself into a freezing lake to like, to say that he got through a race that long, that big over in Europe. Mm-hmm. And like some of the other guys that I really have a tremendous amount of respect for, like, you know, Rob Gray, obviously, and Mark, who pushed me in Worlds last year. Those guys are, they believe in themselves too, right? And it's still a race at the end of the day. I feel like the defining factor, I guess, with regards to when it turns into a competition, then you just rely on what you have learned in the past and what you have been motivated by. I was motivated very much as a kid by doing these insane challenges for stuff that my friends would never do, and just to be able to say I did do it. So.
Since I got you here and you're our reigning champion at Ultraman Canada, one of the other questions that we get a lot from people that are starting out in Ultraman and maybe coming in and doing their first one this year is, you know, they want those nutrition tips, they want those training tips. And another one I think that's important for people to work with during the race that they probably overlook coming up from Ironman is the recovery period. Since we do have the 3 days of racing, what was your plan of how to recover from day to day and like get off the bike? And what do you do until you're on the bike the next day or off the bike and you're on the run the next day? How do you get ready for that next day?
Yeah, no, that's a good point and something that I, you know, I do get asked a bit, but I wish more people would ask about, because it's the fourth discipline. It's bigger than the swim, bike, and run at the end of the day, because you need to take that understanding of recovery into the other three aspects. When I am in the swim and I have 3K left to go in an Ultraman like Canada, you know, I'm changing my stroke mechanics, and I'm actually changing breathing patterns to start to adapt a little bit more to the muscular system that I'm going to be using when I'm on the bike. Mm-hmm. When you're on the bike, obviously, if you aren't thinking about that double marathon, you're going to overcook your legs.
Right.
And then, you know, you getting through that first marathon, if you overcook it there, like, you're not going to get through that second marathon. So, those points in the race, you have to already be planning whatever it is for you that recovery comes into play. For myself, I then also after day one, you know, immediately eat. That's the first thing. You don't feel like eating coming across that line. Like, you really, really don't feel like eating. Mm-hmm. At least I don't. And it's just about like getting as much in you as you possibly can. Like, you got to replenish as many calories as possible. I work with AmpHuman. They make a really amazing recovery product. If you haven't seen, like, you know, Lucy Charles Barclay using it, I'm sure you've seen one of the top performing Ironman guys using their cream. It's a really big game changer when it comes to getting your legs to actually recover and feel better by the next day. If you haven't heard of them, you got to check out AmpHuman. I actually have a discount code. If you guys want to use that, I'll get Larry to,
I'll post that. The show notes for sure.
Yeah. Then, you know, overall stretching, compression, I do bring a recovery pump. Like, I forget actually what the name of mine is. Huh? It was like the cheaper version of the Normatex. It all does the same thing. You just sit in those for as many hours as possible after day one and day two. Mm-hmm. Massage is like good at races if it's provided, but I personally, I don't actually use massage ever in my normal training. So it's not as much of a big indicator. I do find that there's very specific areas that I myself tighten up. Mm-hmm. My psoas is probably the worst of those. I've had kind of a little bit of a history of tightening into my lower back due to different changes in my bike position, different injuries I've had. So that's something I take a lot of attention to as well in the past couple of years. I find that I used to bounce back as a kid. Like we all did, right? And yep. Even though I think I'm probably one of the younger guys that's racing Ultraman still, it's starting to wear on me for sure.
It's a long time in the saddle.
Oh, I'm super tempted to race Canada this year, but I have Worlds again, and I don't know how many more of these like years of doing two of those plus the Ironman race I got in me. So, the recovery aspect, yeah, there's a couple different things you can do in that respect, but also just like really keeping an eye on your nutrition during the day is probably the biggest thing you can do. Not let yourself get too low. It doesn't matter if you drop a bottle, you go back for that bottle in an Ultraman. It's you have to, like, you don't.
Or you count on your crew to be there with another one for you.
Yeah, that's true. I definitely lost my very first long distance race at Ultra 520. I skipped bottles on the first marathon, and I just felt it was so cool, and the temperature was low, and I thought I was fine, and oh, this pace is so much slower than what I train at, right? Yeah. Like, you tell it goes through your head, but then it hits you and there's no coming back from it. They're like, obviously at that distance, even the best, even guys like Rob Gray, who have done more of these than anyone, can still make mistakes, not because of any fault of their own, but just like the experiences that you have gone through in the past 20 hours of racing are probably different than any of the other races you've ever done. And they're going to really stress your body in new and exciting ways. So really paying attention to that and always thinking a few hours ahead of where you are is super important in this style of racing, right?
If you are enjoying this conversation with our UMC 2019 men's champion, Jordan, then make sure to listen to my next episode, which will feature our women's champion, Kat Zeiler. Also in the next episode, I speak with Leanda Cave, who has won world championships at 4 different tri distances. For her, coming to UMC is her way to qualify for Kona in a bid toward winning a 5th world championship. If she gets that victory, she will be the only human on the planet that will be able to say that she holds 5 world titles. Another great reason to follow Ultraman Canada this year and to subscribe to this podcast. That is an interview you will not want to miss. Let's get back to speaking with Jordan. When you were traveling around to the various races, at least on the West Coast here, you spent a lot of time in your van and embraced the van life as your transportation and accommodation. What's it been like for you now that you've been kind of forced to stay in a home base back in Alberta this year, as opposed to having that nomad lifestyle?
Yeah, I felt like last year it was almost a blessing. I had taken a year off racing before in my career, and so like just went out to the West Coast and lived in Tofino and like places like that out of the van was pretty liberating when you realize that no one else is racing, right? Like when you're able to kind of still go, be active, train, not really feel like you're losing anything, and just be content with like exploring all these cool new areas about Canada that maybe you'd only seen on a surface level previously. This winter, though, was definitely the first time I kind of felt like it. I felt kind of like, you know, for snowed in, I guess we could say, here in Canmore.
Right.
It was a different experience for sure. And the last few months have been the hardest of those, simply because I see so many of my friends and my teammates racing already. You know,
right.
We're talking here on a Saturday night, and there's a 70.3 that I think 7 of my teammates are racing in the morning, and so there's a lot of FOMO that goes along with the current situation.
yeah. And have you been like talking with other people in your situation and hearing the same sort of thing where they have that FOMO as well? And
yeah, definitely. There's a few for sure. There's when you have certain ties that you're not able to move forward from, where you can just like go to the States and, you know, train in Texas or Arizona or somewhere where it's a lot more open at the moment. I've seen that's a thing. I've talked to Jeff Simons probably about that kind of topic, about how you're able to kind of do the best that you can. You know, a good Penticton boy like Jeff has an actual job to go to, not only at the bike barn, but he coaches kids, and if he's not on deck coaching kids, like they're not swimming, so he can't just like pick up and go to a training camp whenever he wants either. Yeah, it's been a little bit of restructuring. I did then find a lot of balance when we did have the local facilities open. I felt like a very strong athlete, cross training, using climbing and being back in the pool and embracing cross country skiing and that sort of thing. But it's when the closures kind of started up again that things became a little bit more difficult in that regard.
Yeah, because you think you're going one path and that things are going to open up and it's going to be nice, and then it turns again.
Yeah, kind of absolutely. But I think the biggest message that people need to hear is that like everyone is feeling it. Like the pros are all feeling it. You know, unless you have a substantial income from being a triathlete and you're able to just like go wherever you want, there's only a very select maybe 15, 20 guys in the world that are able to live that lifestyle. The rest of us are feeling it on the same level. You know,
yeah.
I coach athletes. I have 9 athletes that I'm constantly readjusting schedules for as well, that they need to cycle through what their restrictions at work are, what their kid brought you know, came home from school and realized that, oh, there was someone sick in the class. So I'm staying home for 2 weeks. And then that parent isn't getting out for afternoon runs anymore.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge as well with the guys I know that work on site in Fort Mac is oil field workers, because like those sites can be shut down in an instant. And so the regularities of their program is ever changing as well.
Yeah. And yeah, actually that was the next thing I actually wanted to talk to you about is your kind of coaching side gig. I'm guessing that since you've had so many great coaches that you've talked about earlier coming up, and you can take some of the little pieces that you learn from each one of them, some of your own things that you've developed as an athlete. I'm reading Phil Jackson's book right now, the 12 Rings, and it's like a leadership book and a coaching book. And he talks about that, how he takes just a little bit from all the people that coached him as he came up and how it became what he did with the Lakers and the Bulls. I'm guess for you, you probably have that same ability to now when you're coaching, well, this might work for this athlete because I've seen it with this group that I was in and this coach did it for them. Or like, is that how you got your coaching ideas and or is it more an intuitive athletic? I'm an athlete, so I know what it's like as an athlete. Is it coaching or athlete?
It's a combination of the both. I definitely, I feel like I personally have the best coach in the world right now, Julie Gibbons. But I can't definitely coach the way that she coaches me. I can't take that same relationship and transfer it into the people that I'm working with by any means. What I have found though, is that I can rely on, the lessons that I learned specifically between, you know, Cal Zwirsky and Brent Sutton. Those two vastly, like they really influenced my style of coaching quite a bit. When it comes to shorter distance races, like I find that the consistency more than any sort of volume really reflects very well with athletes when it comes to the endurance side of things. It's the understanding that what we're doing is not so much from a muscular perspective an endurance sport, but a strength sport, that I start to see the biggest changes in my athletes. And really just realizing that when you're, say, doing an Ultraman and you're 60K in, what you can do on your long run on a weekend really has no bearing. Like no one, it doesn't come into the equation of what you're dealing with when you're in that situation on a race. You know, I'm preparing my athletes to endure a different style of resistance and resilience at that point. It's definitely not something that you're going to like necessarily read about when it comes to like a power number or any sort of traditional coaching book that was written in the 1980s. It's just a more an understanding of what the actual biomechanics are. And I always kind of come back to like what Sutton says in all of his camps and clinics that he puts on. He's like, okay, well tell me how you do an Ironman. And it's like, oh, well, I train in the pool, and when I get into the pool I do my to go back into the training for an actual Ironman. A lot of people in their busy lives might only get in the pool, what, 3 or 4 times a week at the most. So you get to the pool, you do your warm up and you mix up your strokes, and then you do your kick set and you do your drill set, and then you do your interval set. Or the opposite person just goes in and does super slow laps and just back and forth and back and forth. And there's a happy medium in between those two for sure. Because if I was to look at those traditional kind of swim programs, well, how much swimming are you actually doing 3 times a week? Like how many strokes are you taking at the same race intensity that you do in a race? And if you don't know your how many on average strokes you take in an Ironman, or you don't know how many strokes on average you take in an Ultraman, that's probably a really good place to start.
Yeah.
and then, you know, start to manipulate your training to adjust for that. Like, I don't think you doing a kick set is going to help you in an Ultraman.
No, yeah.
Personally, it's just like, you know, you can use your legs for other things on those days. How many pedal strokes are you taking? You know, how many steps are you actually taking, and what can you do to prepare for that?
So you really take it from the grandest scale of the whole Ultraman, and then just, okay, we're going to break it down backwards and take the science and apply it appropriately, not to just like do volume.
Exactly. That's actually a really good way of putting it. We don't look at like, I read about what my FTP should be in order to be a successful cyclist. Well, a 20-minute test is not going to have any bearing over what you're doing in an Ultraman. You got to start with where you're going, and then you got to take steps back. Right. That's why, like, my athletes, they don't do 20-minute tests. The shortest test they do is 60 minutes long. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a back trend over different theories of coaching. You just can't apply the same coaching techniques, I don't think, personally.
Right. Yeah. And if other people want to check out your coaching philosophy or contact you about it, it's jordanbryden.com. Is that right?
Is that
your main website for that kind of thing? Yeah.
Yeah. Just by email is generally the best. I'll be honest that I do get approached for coaching reasonably regularly, and I'm always willing to take on athletes, but I really like being able to have a direct connection with an athlete from a personality perspective. Mm-hmm. I did work myself with a coach, Tim Crowley, amazing coach out of the States, who coached Jared Shoemaker to the Olympics and some really high end things, and he was the perfect coach on paper. You know, he had a very good understanding about IT racing and strength racing, but I just never felt like I had that connection with him that I could just, you know, go and chat with him about anything and not have a response that would directly impact my training. Mm-hmm. So I want to be able to talk to someone freely. I don't want to feel like when I'm dealing with an athlete that if I say something, they're going to get their back up, or vice versa. That is the definition, in my opinion, of a good coaching relationship first. It has nothing, you know, to do beyond that start anyways.
Yeah, that's totally reasonable. If you're going to be spending time with this person and be invested in what they're doing, you want to make sure you're on the same page and able to have that good relationship.
Yeah, no, I like, and I've seen a lot of people just get with coaches because they're popular, and I've seen really successful coaches with athletes that, you know, win major races just simply because they know how to communicate.
Getting back to your work, you work as a graphic designer. Everybody needs to pay their bills to be able to go out and do these races. So this is your main one. What's it all about?
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. And it's a lot of creativity that I've found has probably given me a lot of longevity in the sport. When you're using the other side of your brain, it seems to make me just, I don't know, maybe a little bit more balanced in some ways. So when I'm on a laptop trying to basically take things that inspired me throughout the day and then apply them to individual designs, or, you know, look at, I did a big run with the Ponte Verde World Championships in 2019 that I just like took a lot of inspiration from knowing the area and then taking that into the design. I really enjoy the ability to kind of flex that side of my brain a little bit. I do design for a number of different clients in the sport industry beyond my work with World Triathlon, because we I work for Tribe Solutions, a Vancouver-based company that kind of works across the globe in a variety of different establishments. So I not only work on that, but like I designed all of Triathlon Ireland's gear last year, and I'm also designing the entire Metasport series in Asia right now. And so all of these different little areas that need merchandise, you know, it grew out of me just like helping my local store make their first bike jersey.
and we're hoping that you're going to make ours for the upcoming race as well.
That's right. I made the last one. I'll be making the next one too. So yeah,
that's great.
No, it's a different creativity side of things, right? So if you're able to kind of like just do something that makes you think differently, I think it's a good thing.
So I got one more thing for you. I know that you own a few of your own running races, but over the COVID times here, you also put on a special event, the Solitary Confinement, which I'm sure people listening, some of them were following or participating in. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And I saw that you were going to try and run it again, but it got postponed. So maybe give us an update on what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. So Solitary Confinement was kind of built around the same idea as the Backyard Ultra idea, but a little bit more based on the bike. So if there's anyone listening that, you know, understands what the Backyard Ultra was about, it's effectively a set course, usually around 6.4K, where everybody starts and runs the course and you have to finish it within an hour. And then the gun goes again at the hour, and then you go and you run. And that process takes place until there's only one person left standing. It's a very pure form of endurance, right? It's not a hard distance for a lot of people to finish in under an hour. Mm-hmm. But the mental resolve and the attention to recovery and all the extracurricular things that can come in during that period are pretty interesting how all of those races turned out. So when we're stuck inside and a lot of people are embracing Zwift, I figured like, okay, let's do the same idea on the Tempest Fugit loop on Zwift, which is, you know, about a 40-minute ride for most people. So when we first ran it, the idea was that everyone would finish the loop and then get back and start again. And we would do that all together for 12 or 24 hours, whatever your poison was. And then after that 24 hours, it was kind of just, well, let's just have a death finish. Let's just see how it goes. So people got on their bikes and that was it. You just had to keep riding. We had to maintain above, I think the first year was 100 watts. And it came down to two guys that had been on their bikes for a very long time. And unfortunately I had to make a call at some point because, you know, wattage is definitely not perfect, but we started to just monitor people's wattages to see if it was dipping at all, if it was going below for any period of time. And that's how Chris Camilano, I think is how you say his last name, ended up being the winner. Chris is kind of a little bit of a legend when it comes to the endurance scene. He's raced Ultraman Worlds. He's got quite a few interesting records to his name. Oh man, I can't even begin to describe the way that guy is able to push himself, not only on a bike, but on the run as well. You know, Death Valley. But that was the purpose behind trying to bring people together online, and, you know, trying to just activate the Ultra community a little bit when we weren't able to come together at Ultraman type events.
Right.
Yeah. So the next version of it, I think we are going to do instead as a little bit of a different format where we allow people to get off whenever they want to. But then just, you know, base it a little bit more around the 24-hour period than anything else, and leave it a little bit more driven by, the distance covered on that course.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the idea.
You get that bathroom break in when you need it.
Yeah. No, I think there's something obviously intimidating around the idea of just sitting on your bike that long. But there's also something that's really positive that came out the other side. I couldn't believe how many people like actually took the time to write emails after to say like, hey, thanks for putting this type of event on. I didn't know I could do this. Like I had no idea I could ride a bike for this long in a day. Right. And the format just like really led to that understanding, I think, where, you know, my mom, who has never done more than a sprint distance triathlon, got on her bike and did 12 of them. And yeah, it was pretty awesome. So,
And I think you had a charity component along with that too, did you?
Yeah, we definitely contributed a good amount of cash. I think it worked out to about 6,300 US to the Challenge Athlete Foundation. Bob Babbitt obviously has a very close relationship with the ultra community, and he is a board member there and a very a founding member of the CAF. And then so with the Challenge Athlete Foundation, I found that they've done such a good job at supporting different athletes and really growing the sport in a different level, and to see the inspiration that comes from para athletes as well as athletes that you know, have other challenges, like Chris Nikic, who just was the first athlete with Down syndrome that finished Ironman late last season. I guess it's not last season now, but the last season that we had back in 2019. So yeah, extremely motivating individuals that really do an amazing job at inspiring others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. That's great that you were able to get a little bit of cash for the foundation.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Jordan, for giving me so much time. I'll make sure to post in the show notes. If you go to the website where the podcast is downloaded from, I always have all of the information listed for people to go back and look for the races that are mentioned or the people that are mentioned. And in your case with the AMP Human, we'll post your code. Thank you very much for your time today, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's great seeing you, Larry. No, I hope to see you again in person sometime this year, and with any luck, it'll be at a race.
Absolutely.
All right,
thanks a lot. Yeah.
Now here's another Steve King story.
So the next man I'm going to introduce you to is someone we like to refer to as a honey badger. Many of you know what that means. He is a person who's done around 25 Ironmen in his career. It's been a long career. He has got a sub 10 hour performance to his credit at the Ironman distance, recorded that here in my hometown of Penticton in 1997 at Ironman Canada. But he has returned a number of times to this community. And in fact, he is a four-time finisher of Ultraman Canada, having taken the victory in 1994 and in 1999 when he recorded a 25:19:05 clocking. However, in 1994, we had a fire and had to change the swim course portion of the event. So we ended up doing a 12K out and back loop swim, a 200-mile double century bike ride, and then a double marathon, of course. Now, one of the amazing things about his victory in 1994 was the fact that he was the only person to go sub 3 hours for the swim, recorded a magnificent 2-hour-42 clocking. He also returned in 2005, got second overall then, and 2011 and got 14th position. One of the most amazing events, so in terms of not only the distances, but also the time between the top two, was in Canberra at the 3-day ultra, which consists of a 15K swim, 400K bike, and 100K run. And this man came second overall by a mere 19 seconds. Think about that in terms of the distance, in terms of the closeness of that finish. He's also a three-time double Ironman finisher, did that event also in Quebec, Canada. But if you follow him on social media, you see that he's all over the place. He's often in Thailand. You'll see him in Malulabar, in Noosa, the home of Ultraman Australia, of course, and here in Penticton, at Ultraman Canada. He is a true triathlon aficionado. He devotes countless hours answering questions, providing advice, and supporting fellow triathletes. I'm referring, of course, to the great Australian, Mr. Nick Mallett.
Today's Ultraman Canada athlete in profile has been dreaming of doing Ultraman since he was 16 years old and found out about ultra triathlon. He started Ironman races as soon as he could at age 18 and has also competed at a number of ultra marathons. Now, at the ripe age of 21, he will be the youngest to finish Ultraman Canada if he makes that day three finish this year. From Walla Walla, Washington, just over the British Columbia border in the U.S., my guest today is Andrew Peterson. Welcome.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
Good. Just having a nice, relaxing little couple of days since I just did a 50K on Saturday, the Badger Mountain 50K, and just having a couple of days off before we get back to work this weekend with some fun, gnarly trainer miles.
Yeah. So despite all the COVID restrictions that are going on there, you're one of the few that's been lucky enough to actually get back into racing. Tell me a little bit about this Badger Mountain Ultra. How far was it? How'd you do?
So it was a 34-mile race just in outside of Walla Walla. It's in this little area called Tri-Cities. And it was, on paper, it looked like a flatter 50K that I've done. But it had, you just go straight up this little mountain, go straight back down it. Then there's another little mountain, you go straight back up. And then on paper, it was supposed to look like there was this nice, just flat, deep roads that were coming. But it turns out those deep roads were just all up and down that would just beat your legs up until you get back to climbing. Finished with my best friend who's actually training for his first Ironman. He did his first ultra marathon, his first marathon ever. I got him to come out there and do that with me. We finished in 7 hours total and we got to cross the finish line together. So it was a super awesome experience to get him out there and doing that and just getting back into racing and getting just back happy with like how life's going in the ultra scene finally again.
Yeah. Well, hopefully with all these vaccines coming out, you know, more races will be back up and running shortly.
As a person who's been lucky enough to get my first dose, I'm hoping I'll be able to just go out to whatever races I can, whatever races are available, and like with having vaccinations and just keep on moving. And as long as people are getting vaccinated, I don't see there being an issue of racing, but time will tell.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And we're definitely still very hopeful that we'll be running our race this year, that it's not going to get postponed again. So we're keeping our fingers crossed on that one. We don't have the full go ahead yet, but we're definitely fingers crossed.
Hopefully in May, that's when we will start getting stuff booked up and ready to go on that aspect. And I'm very, very anxious and excited to get to do something I've been wanting to do since I was 16.
Yeah. And you said you just, the last run you did, it was your friend's first marathon. Yep. And yeah, you did your first marathon at age 14. Is that correct?
Yes.
How does that occur? Do you come from a family of runners?
No, I came from when I was 13 years old, I ran my first half marathon. Kind of just like as a thing to do after football season was over when I was little. And it just stuck with me. I love going out there and just suffering for X amount of miles and then just coming back. I've just always been drawn to that type of thing. I've been swimming since I could ever remember. Swimming has been a super attribute part of my, really important part of my life. And it's been endurance sports to kind of like lift that up, like with swimming, those the first step, and then running, and then somehow picked up cycling. But yeah, running longer distances has always been just somewhat of an anomaly to me, and I always want to get back out there and see how far I can go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a high school PE teacher. And I coach as well, and I know my best cross country runners have always been swimmers.
That's, we had our swim. I never was on the cross country team. I thought their distances were too short. but, so I would swim almost year round. always swimming. And then I would just run here and there. But like a lot of my base endurance all comes from that beautiful swimming background. And it really has worked out super, like swimming long, like on my bucket list. Hopefully if everything were to work out, like cost wise, I would love to swim the Catalina Channel next year, but that's a little too out of my price range right now. But I would love to get into longer open water marathon swimming. That's like, that would be my big, big passion if I could ever be financially stable enough to do that.
Yeah. And so you said you played football as well in high school?
Yeah, I played football just my freshman year. Then I started playing tennis. I'm 6'1" and left-handed. So that really was a good connection with tennis. Got to be a little chaotic with that, with like sprinting. But that's actually when I started started doing ultras at 16. And that's kind of where everything with that, with tennis and that, kind of just bounced off each other. And I was able to find a healthy balance, I guess, so to say, with swimming, tennis, and just ultra running in general.
Yeah. Well, that's quite a mix of sports there.
Yeah. It definitely, lots of people from, I'm originally from Bismarck, North Dakota. I'm just out in Walla Walla for college right now. And that, you, lots of three sport athletes. Usually you would never have someone who just is one mono sport athlete. Everyone played football, track, everyone did everything.
There's the fall season, the winter season, the spring season.
Yeah. You know it.
That's what I try and get all my athletes to do.
It prevents injury, I think. And that's been something I've been super thankful to never have, like major, major injuries. And I think it just keeps the body happy and healthy, like kind of how triathlon is three major disciplines.
Right. Yeah. Now, looking at your previous results, you've already faced your share of adversities in races. You got DQ'd in your first Ironman race. Is that correct?
Correct. So the Ironman Boulder, I was, how can I explain this? I was not hallucinating, but I was so tired on the bike that I actually missed the turnaround. It was like a short little 2 mile circle, but I actually got to miss that. So they deked me for missing for 2 miles, which was a bummer because got to do every other single part besides that little 2 mile section. So I consider I have done 2.999 of an Ironman for that half of that, but she works out. That was a really thankful experience. It actually got me. There are a whole bunch of other people who got deked because of that, just miss on the turn. So Ironman actually gave me a 50% off race for Ironman Boulder the year after, which was super nice. I got to go and redeem myself.
Yeah, but, you always want to go back and get that race.
And it was the last year for Ironman Boulder too, which was, it's a notoriously pretty nasty course, but I'm very happy. If a course is flat, I don't do well on it. That's kind of, especially the biking wise, which Ironman Arizona was definitely a nightmare bike ride, but otherwise it's, as long as it's nice and hilly and long, I will do fine at it. But if it's flat, there's no chance in heck I'm going to do well with it.
Well, hilly and long is all you're going to get at Ultraman Canada.
Looking at elevation profiles has been one of my favorite things to do ever since I like found out what ultra endurance sports are. And Ultraman Canada's elevation profile, let me tell you, it's a thin of beauty, and I'm excited to take her on.
Excellent. Yeah, that's what we want to hear. With some of your other big ultra marathons, you did the Bigfoot 200 miler. And again, a little bit of adversity. What happened in that one?
So made it to a mile 157. Sleep deprivation. So the first night, it was the worst weather they've ever had during that race. Giant thunderstorm. My phone actually broke. So I had no access to podcasts or music, after mile 50. So that was for the longer races, being out there alone on the trail for that long of a period, your brain just goes to death on you and you need like something to distract your brain. So not having a phone, super detrimental. And then the third night, I got lost for 4 miles, which when you're going that slow for 200 miler, that's about like 2 hours you're off trail. So it was not super ideal with that. Then sleep deprivation is a major thing. That's why I'm really happy this is a stage race and just not one shot because of how poor I am at managing sleep. It's definitely for the longer distances. I got to get better at like making sure caffeine intake's fine, practicing when I'm just tired and hallucinating. Otherwise, that could have probably been practiced a little better for Bigfoot 200, but hopefully not this year, but the year after I'll go back to Bigfoot and redeem myself and keep on trugging with those just long, painful races.
When you got to the realization in that race that you weren't going to be able to continue on, how long had you been going before you pulled the plug, and what were you thinking about? What were you feeling at that time?
So I remember waking, I had my three closest friends. They were crewing me at the time. I woke up in the back of my girlfriend's car. And I wake up, I'm like, I can't, we were walking to start cause she was going to pace me for a little bit. And I started like, I was bent over on my poles, just crying. I couldn't go, like, it was just, I was so tired. Then after that, I slept for, I think, 20 some hours straight in this little rundown hotel in middle of nowhere, Washington, and just dealing with like, you're so close, but you're so far. And it just was like the biggest mental block. That's definitely an issue I've had to overcome being such a younger athlete, I think. I definitely don't have the wisdom as much as these older athletes do when it comes to knowing when to push on. Looking back on it, I should have kept pushing on, but here we are. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely, mental toughness has always been something I am trying to improve and work more towards. And I think that DNF really was the turning point, I guess, in my ultra running and just like endurance sport career, so to say. Like, I'm very thankful. That was the best thing that could have ever happened to me, that DNF. And it really awoke a lot of motivation and strength into myself.
Hmm. Yeah. As you said, this is not really a young person's sport. Like all of your colleagues at this race, you know, they're 30s, 40s, 50s. It's one of those things that you grow into, that you learn, and you've kind of just jumped in at the young age you did. So, I mean, I give you all the credit for going out and taking those lumps and. And I suspect you'll have a few more in Ultraman, but now that you've had that experience where, you know, it's like, but if I push on, hopefully you've got that built up now.
Learning to push has definitely been something that will all, like, just training in general, like if you ever want to just stop in training, just knowing to push past that barrier, it's definitely been something that has super, super helped me. And just racing against people that are double my age, it's really fun because those people are like, they have so much knowledge and they're so much fun to talk to. Mm-hmm. Lots of older ultra runners. I remember my first year at Speed Goat watching some just guy who was probably in his like 60s, just pass me on this ginormous climb. And just these older people, when it comes to endurance sports, are just so fascinating and so much fun to be around and learn from. And I'm very thankful I have every opportunity to learn from them.
Yeah. So what's been your favorite race so far that you've done?
Speed Goat 50K. It is a 50K out of Snowbird, Utah. Carl Metzler puts it on. He's won the most 100-mile. He's won 4,200 milers. So he knows how to make people himself suffer, and he wants everyone to suffer on this race. It's a 50K with over 15,000 feet of climb. It's the bigger, numbers, 15,000 feet of climbing. So you are just going up, 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 then up some more. Then you go down into this ravine and then you climb back up it. Every year Carl's at the finish line and I always want to tackle him after the finish line. It's the hardest thing I have ever done. And it's the most rewarding thing I have ever done. And I love it so much.
And how many times have you done that one?
I've done that twice. Ultraman Canada is the same weekend as that. So hopefully won't get to do it this year. But if Canada gets postponed, I will go down there and do it. Even if it was a week after Ultraman Canada, I would be going down there. It's just so much fun. And I'm so thankful I get to do it.
So do you have a coach or a guide, someone that is sharing their knowledge with you to help you get into this ultra thing?
I've had two coaches. So I had a ultra running coach before. I kind of was more triathlon centered. Brian Montgomery. He's blowing up in the ultra running scene, so to say. Super, super amazing runner. He's been a great mentor to me. Then I switched to a triathlon more centered coach, Keegan Hurley. He's out of Austin, Texas. He was in the Olympic developmental program. So he's not familiar with the super long stuff, but he has been super adaptive with like knowing what to do, I guess, when it comes to coaching me, and it has been a blast. And without him, I would be super lost.
That's a good shout out then.
Yeah, it's definitely, he's taking new athletes if anyone wants to pick up a coach, but I've been super lucky. He's in his upper 20s. So it's been super great because we have like that kind of like almost age similarity where we get to like kind of goof around, and like he knows how important recovery is to me. And he especially balancing everything of school, he's like actively in college, right? Like in postgraduate school right now. So he knows how hard it is to balance training in school. Mm-hmm. And he does a very good job with coaching me through that.
And is this all done virtually, or do you go to camps from time to time, or?
He puts on camps. I haven't been able to go to anything with school, but mostly everything. I call him about once a week. We chat, training peaks, all the usual stuff. Mm-hmm. And keep everything just nice and low key and fun. And if it's not fun, there's no reason why you should do it.
Yeah. I think we got a pretty good idea of who you are as an athlete now. One of the things I like to do with the athlete profiles is to make sure that we get to know you a little personally as well. So like when you show up at the race and you can find out who are these people that have the things in common with you. And usually when I do these interviews, I do a quick lightning round in between those two aspects of the interview. So we talk about your athlete stuff, and then we talk about your personal stuff. And in between, I do this 2 minutes in transition. So I'm just going to give you some lightning questions. You give me some lightning answers. Perfect. And then we'll talk a little more on the other side.
Wonderful.
Okay. So other than the Catalina swim, what is something that's on your bucket list or on your radar?
Tour de Jeanne. It's a 200 miler in Italy that has over 100,000 feet of climbing. That's been on my bucket list ever since I found out what ultra running is. The more vert, the better.
All right. What is your go-to workout music?
Oh, probably any EDM. Anything that's super loud and takes the pain away.
What is the last book that you read that wasn't a textbook?
Stillness by Ryan Holiday. Love Ryan Holiday. Super great.
And do you still enjoy reading for pleasure, or as a student, do you just read too much? And
so
read, or do you just do audiobooks?
My bedtime routine's pretty specific. So every night I actually read for a half hour while I'm in bed. It helps just relax me and turn my brain off. So I read for pleasure for a half hour every night, which has been super great.
Excellent. Have you taken up any COVID hobbies?
No, just more training. Doing remote internships. That's a great COVID hobby.
Okay, last one. What is something that you are good at?
That is very making tofu scrambles. My girlfriend says we have those every Saturday after long, long, painful days. Get to make a whole bunch of those. So good at putting a whole bunch of ingredients into a pan and frying it up.
All right. Now, that's the second time you've mentioned your girlfriend, and you said that you had your best friends crewing with you. So maybe you better mention these people. Will they be crewing at Ultraman?
Yes, my girlfriend, Emma Patterson, will be crewing me at Ultraman. She's the one for sure crew. There's my two other best friends. If they can get work off, they will be coming. That's the great part about being a student. But I have a very amazing group of support that I don't think I could do this without. The girlfriend gets to deal with 4:30 wake ups. The alarms going off, her getting to wake up at 4:30 when I sleep through my alarm to wake me up. She has to deal with the loud trainer sometimes that's right next to our bedroom. She's the rock that I need when I'm in a super low place. And she's just been the stability through all of this rigorous Ultraman training. I'm so lucky to have her.
Yeah. That's the kind of people you need when you're out there on the Ultraman course as well.
The Ultraman crewing will hopefully be a lot easier than Bigfoot crewing. They had to deal with lightning storms, driving in pitch black, and lots of sleep deprivation. It sounded like their experience was almost as hard as mine. So I'm super excited to have them have a normal crewing experience, so to say.
Yeah. So what is your life currently like as a student? Where are you attending? What's your program? What's that going on?
I go to Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. I am pre-law, so to say. So I'm second philosophy. And it's been a wild adventure. I'm super happy I ended up here, but it took me a while to find at home. But once I found home, get the routine and just keep everything nice and neat with the routine. But it's been very, very an awesome experience. And I'm super lucky to be out here.
And what do you hope to do with it all when you graduate it?
I would love to go into prison reform law. The goal is to hopefully end up in Colorado at University of Boulder for law school so I can be at altitude. This is how much my life revolves around training. I would love to go to a law school that's at altitude. That's hopefully go to University of Boulder and do prison reform law there. That is the end game goal with that. If being a almost professional endurance junkie doesn't get me anywhere.
That doesn't get too many people too far.
Oh no, but hey, we're out here trying our best.
Yeah. So what are the other various aspects of your life then that demand your attention and that force you to find balance between the girlfriend, the training, the school and everything else? What else goes on and how do you balance all those things?
You don't. No, 4:30, really early wake ups. Usually I get 2 to 3 workouts in before 8 o'clock in the morning. Then usually from like 8 to 10, just homework. I'm a the philosophy aspect of my major. You read 200-ish pages a week. Sometimes I'll read on the trainer. That's been a thing that's for longer bike rides that are just more static. You just get one of your things you print off and you just read 30 pages on the trainer. It's not super fun, but it gets the job done. It's just finding that great balance, making sure you have time to take care of yourself and to like have a list. Lists have been really super helpful for me, going through a little check off in the mornings, like what do I need to get done? Prioritization. So if I have a paper coming up, I prioritize the paper over training. Yes, that means you might have to do less training for that day, but like just making sure the priorities are set for the day so you don't get things stacked upon you. Because when things pile up and get stacked upon you, it becomes unbearable. So you find that balance to make sure everything doesn't cave in on you, so to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess when you're out racing, maybe that's some time to reflect as well on all of those things because you're out there for so long and reevaluate. And
Saturday morning long runs, I don't bring any music. I don't bring anything. It's just me and my own thoughts. Get up at 4:30, either go out to the mountains. I'm about like a 30-minute drive by some really nice little foothill mountains, which is super wonderful. Or you just go up, you go on the road and gear up down there and you just have your own thoughts to balance and just think about yourself through that. And it's really, really, really wonderful.
Yeah. And I guess with school and all and the stresses that come with that, that gives you that chance to just decompress off of those things.
School stress has definitely been very scattered throughout. It definitely will sometimes put a divot into training, so to say. My coach has been super flexible with understanding sometimes schoolwork needs to come first. Usually weekends, if I know I can get in all my long stuff, I feel good and happy about that. So sometimes you just have to sacrifice the little small recovery or workouts to make sure you can have that like Friday long swim, Saturday long run, Sunday long bike, so to say, and like just making sure every like the long stuff is there in order to like have that good little training school work balance.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's anything that you've given up in your life to pursue triathlon?
Partying. Partying has definitely been something I've definitely had to give up since coming out to college. Lots of staying in, going to bed at 9 o'clock.
That doesn't sound like college.
I know. It's definitely been a weird... It's nice in the time of COVID. I don't get to look super weird staying at 9 o'clock on a Friday night and get ready for bed so I can get up at 4:30, go do a long run. But triathlon has been way more important to me than just about anything when it comes to like that stuff. So yes, you have to have some early morning or early nights, but it's been very, I think it's very worth it. Sleeping, giving that extra sleep so you can do those long runs, so you can have that perfect little happy balance, so to say.
Mm, yeah. Well, you know, getting up at 4:30 regularly is going to do well for you, because that's about the time people get up for Ultraman.
It's 4:30 wake-ups have been a thing going on in my life since probably little before COVID, last when COVID first started. I just, the training stress, realizing that I need to balance, find that balance more. And like 4:30 has been that time when the alarm goes off, drink the coffee for 15 minutes, then go hop in the trainer or go hop in the pool. My high school swim team, actually, we were the only high school, I think, in North Dakota that would do, we did constant morning workouts. So we'd work out from 5 o'clock in the morning till, or no, it would be six till seven. But like just getting that installed to me at like ever since I was 13 years old, that like waking up in the morning and going to work out is just like just a normal thing that's part of your routine, has been, I'm really, really thankful that got installed to me at a young age so I can get just more stuff done and find that greater balance, because I can't get most stuff done at night. So once we get everything done in the morning, the afternoon, and just have like nighttime to unwind, read, do a little bit of homework here and there, but have that nighttime be more restorative, so to say. It's been very, very lucky to have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Andrew, I'd like to thank you for giving me your time and coming and introducing yourself. And I know the other athletes that are listening to the podcast will appreciate getting to know a little bit about you before they meet you. And hopefully you're listening to theirs and doing the same. And I thank you once again for giving me your time.
Thank you guys so much. Looking forward to seeing you guys in July, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
If you hung around this long waiting to hear the crew story, I have some bad news. I don't have one for you this time. I did not get any submissions. But if you have a crew story you would like to submit, I would be happy to air it. Check out the show notes for contact information, and I'll be glad to tell you how to record yours. Also, remember, you will find everything and everyone mentioned in this episode in those notes as well. My next episode with Kat Zeiler and Leanne DeCave will be available May the 14th. Till then, stay safe and keep training.
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, please tell a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd rate and review the show while you're there. Drop the names of the people you think we should interview, and we'll get in touch with them and make that happen. Thank you for listening to 515, the Ultraman Podcast, a production of 55 Enterprises, brought to you by Ultraman Canada. Now really, go subscribe now before you forget.